until February 1st of next year. And the very first Sunday that we were in California, we came to visit at this church. And I've been here for a few special events, including the speaker. Mike, what's the name of the author? This is my husband, Mike.
Eric Metaxas.
That was wonderful. Yeah, yeah. So we've enjoyed being here a number of times. So my topic this morning, and actually the primary focus of my work during this year at Reasons to Believe, is to counter something that's going on in our culture right now, which is called the Evo-Devo movement. And that stands for evolution development. And the basic concept that's being promoted by those people who are in the Evo-Devo movement is that since the same major genes that control our development are the genes that control the development of all animals, that's a proof that we evolved and we're just another animal. In reality, in my research that I've done so far, it's clear that saying that is no more equivalent, is no more thoughtful and insightful than saying we have a head, four limbs, a stomach, the same kind of basic body plan that many organisms have. Beyond that, once you get past that very superficial level, the uniqueness of humanity, biologically speaking, comes into focus. But even though it does come into focus, it's still very early on in research. There's a lot that just isn't known yet. Embryology is an extraordinarily complex field. In case you don't know, embryology refers to the time in the womb where the embryo is developing and where tissues are becoming unique. For example, you're developing liver tissue and kidney tissue and brain tissue. And that process is called differentiation, where cells differentiate themselves from other cells. And so that's the basic process that we'll be talking about today. So the evidence of human uniqueness pervades our world. From the moment that humans trod upon this earth, they have enriched it with art, music, civilization, and worship of God. Their distinctiveness from all the species that preceded them is so dramatic that archaeologists refer to the moment in time that humans began to walk on the earth as the cultural Big Bang or the Big Bang of the mind. Archaeologists, geologists, paleontologists all examine the record of life on this planet, and that's a history of as much as 3.5 to 3.8 billion years where there's been life on this planet. But nothing they see in all those years compares to what they suddenly see appear in the archaeological records some 45,000 to 75,000 years ago when humans began to walk the earth. Suddenly, with humans, with modern humans, Homo sapiens sapiens, suddenly there's an explosion of art, musical instruments, jewelry, and other artifacts of culture. There's a sudden and dramatic increase in the diversity and sophistication of the tools devised and employed by this newest creature. One of the most well-known examples of this time in history is the cave art you see here before you. As Christians, we believe the uniqueness of humans is attributable most of all to the fact that we are created in the image of God. I think I'm going to move this because I'm feeling blocked in. And I think, can those of you who are sitting over here see over me if I'm standing here? Okay. It's nothing that's actually critical yet so far, so. Some aspects of being made in the image of God are not detectable by naturalistic means. For example, the existence of the soul. However, other aspects of the image, for example, intelligence, have a clear biological basis. Sometimes as Christians we feel embattled and almost overwhelmed by our secular culture and the low value of humanity that exists within a purely naturalistic framework. Actually, I think I'm going to use this. Let's go back and forth here. However, it's important to be aware that there are many scientists who are devoted to understanding the uniqueness of human biology. In order to achieve the goals of their research, for example, curing certain diseases, they need to understand what makes humans unique, not how similar we are to chimps. Their awareness of just how dramatic the differences are between us and chimps is evident in the scientific literature. On the screen, you see quotes from recent scientific papers in which scientists express their frustration with the lack of understanding of the biological mechanisms that underlie that uniqueness. The first quote, despite striking differences in cognition and behavior between humans and our closest primate relatives, several studies have found little evidence for adaptive change in protein coding regions of genes expressed primarily in the brain. Second, the developmental mechanisms through which the cerebral cortex increased in size and complexity during primate evolution are essentially unknown. Thirdly, neglecting or minimizing evolutionary differences, of course we don't believe in evolution, but this is the quote, neglecting or minimizing evolutionary differences between the species may be among the reasons for the failure of many clinical trials that were based exclusively on the highly promising findings in rodents. Today, we'll focus on the embryology of that remarkable entity, the human brain. There's a uniqueness in the human brain that is evident at all levels. From the time of gestation, the amount of time spent in gestation, and the gross anatomy of the human brain right down to the level of individual molecules in the human brain. And the uniqueness of the human brain is created primarily during the in utero phase of life, which is prolonged. It's 9 months for humans, 8 months for chimps, and far less for other species. In general, of course, I think elephants have a longer time, but that's due to size. It's not really. After birth, the human brain continues to develop in unique ways, and its biochemistry remains unique throughout the lifetime of the individual, but the most dramatic evidences of the uniqueness of the human mind are found in its developmental phases. So let's start by examining the difference in the human brain with regard to time. So we see that humans have a prolonged period of in utero brain development, and they actually have a prolonged period of postnatal brain development. If you took a chimp and looked at its skills at, say, 3 months and a human at 3 months, the chimp would seem to be ahead. And that's because the human brain is lagging behind in development in a certain sense. It's lagging behind intentionally by design. The greater time that the human brain spends in this still developing phase means that it's very plastic for a very extended period of time. When I say plastic, I mean it's able to change and acquire new synapses. New synapses are connections between nerve cells, mean intelligence, knowledge. And so the extended period of time that we have for in utero brain development as well as postnatal brain development leads to a greater intelligence in the human brain. But that's only one tiny aspect of it, the time. During that time, things are going on that are completely different in the human than are going on in a chimp brain. So certainly by the time you get to a certain age, humans just absolutely outstrip chimps, as we all know. Okay, so time, we're going to, through this process, this lecture today, we're going to look at a lot of different levels of differences. We're going to start at the macroscopic level with things like time, and we're going to end up at the level of individual molecules at the end. Yes?
You open to questions?
I think we need to let them all wait till the end, unless there's something you don't understand.
Well, you said the mom kissing her baby. This time is a time when lots of inputs are given to the baby.
Right. That's right. Okay. Okay. So unless you don't understand something, let's hold the questions to the end, okay? Because otherwise, it won't work well, okay? Okay. Okay, so there's some background concepts that we need. Let's look at the parts of the human brain. The large brown area that you see here is our cerebrum, and the cerebellum is the magenta colored. The limbic system and the brainstem are hidden underneath here. You can't really see them here. So these are the major parts, and the cerebrum is the part of the human brain that is most unique from other species. We have changes in all of the areas. I would say after the cerebrum, the next biggest area of change is the cerebellum. But all of them are different, but the cerebrum is really where the astounding differences are. So we're going to focus on the cerebrum primarily today. The mammals have, fish and amphibians have a very small cerebrum. Reptiles have larger. Mammals have the largest, with chimps having the largest outside of humans. But even with chimps, there's just no comparison to humans. The human cerebrum is 10 times larger than the chimp cerebrum and much more complex, but the extent of its complexity beyond the chimps is not known. We don't have a good handle on just how far it outstrips the chimp. Yes?
Cerebrum the same as cerebral cortex?
The cerebral cortex, and we're going to talk about that on an upcoming slide, okay, the cerebral cortex. And in fact, that's a very important thing that we'll be focusing on, is the cerebral cortex. Okay. So the cerebrum itself is divided into four lobes, the frontal lobe. And the frontal lobe is really, of all the lobes of the cerebrum, it's the most unique of all the lobes in our cerebrum. It's our executive center, where we do reasoning, planning, where we control movements, where emotions go on, where we do problem solving, complex problem solving. Chimps can engage in some simple problem solving, but of course we solve calculus equations and figure out how to go to the moon. Our parietal lobe also controls movement, but it's primarily involved in perception and recognition. The temporal lobe is where we have, that stands for time. We use it for hearing, for memory, and speaking. And the occipital lobe does all of the visual processing. Yes? Oh, okay. This is the frontal lobe in blue. And then the parietal lobe is here. And the temporal lobe and the occipital lobe. Okay. So, but we're really going to focus on the cerebrum as a whole and the cerebral cortex in particular. We'll mention the other lobes somewhat, but you don't have to really know much about them to get the sense of this lecture. Okay? But if you just want to know. Okay. Cerebral cortex. Okay. Our cerebrum is composed of two important layers, and in common language we refer to them as the gray matter and the white matter of the brain. You've heard those terms before. The gray matter is the cerebral cortex, okay? And it is a layer of cells, shown here in dark purple, that are on the surface of our brain. So that's the cerebral cortex. Notice how convoluted it is. And it consists of six layers of neurons, and each of these layers has a distinct characteristics. And all of these neurons need to be connected to one another and to other parts of the body. And so the neurons sit up here in these six layers, and their extensions, which are called dendrites, come out of them and run through the white matter. And in fact, the dendrites of the neurons make up the white matter. So the gray color of the cerebral cortex comes from the neuron cell bodies, the cell bodies themselves. And then their dendrites, or their connection that they make to other cells, give the other part of the brain its white color. Okay? So the gray matter and the white matter of the brain. Now, in humans, we have more neurons than any other species. And because the neurons are only located in the top six layers, in order to get more neurons packed into those top six layers, you can't make them thicker. Right? You can't make those six layers thicker because for some reason it needs to be structured the way it is. Probably because you'd have too many fibers coming out if you had more thickness in the layers. What you need is more surface area to fit those neurons in. And in order to accomplish that, to get more surface area, ours our cerebral cortex is highly convoluted, much more convoluted than any other species. And in fact, this slide happens to be from a monkey, but it was the best slide I could get to show this information. If you saw ours, it would be much more convoluted. And we do have a slide showing that comparison in just a moment. Okay. So we're continuing at the macroscopic level with just a growth comparison. Here is a mouse shown from a side view in a cross section. Here is macaque, the type of chimp, macaque monkey, and that's shown from the side and in cross section in the human. Now, the mouse completely lacks a prefrontal cortex, doesn't have one at all. Here's the chimp prefrontal cortex, and here's the human. Remember I told you that the prefrontal cortex is the most distinct area of the cortex itself, of the cerebrum. So it greatly enlarged in humans. And if you look at this in cross-section, you can see that there's really no convolutions in the mice. There's some here, but many, many more in the human. So the other slide that I would have shown you, if I had gotten been able to get a human one, it would have been much more convoluted in that. Okay. Now, this is actually kind of a nice slide. I just wanted to show you what the neurons or nerve cells actually look like, and I'm going to use the term neurons for the rest of the talk. The neurons on this slide are shown in the dark black, the cell body. Remember I said the cell bodies constitute the gray matter. They're very dense microscopically, and that's why they give that gray color to the brain tissue. And then the fibers that come out from them are these thin, spindly things, and they're very long in reality. They go long distances. So these are the dendrites that are coming out of those cells. And in the background, you see some other cell types. So this is what neurons look like when you get a good view of them. Of course, if this was in the cerebral cortex, they'd be packed much more closely together in the cerebral cortex. This is another area of the of nerve tissue. Okay. Now, so we're going to talk now about human uniqueness at the microscopic level. A recent discovery found that humans have neurons at a far earlier stage in development than anyone had believed possible. Embryogenesis, the development of an organism, is marked by several critical stages. And one of the most critical sort of landmark stage that happens in all mammalian species is what's called the closing of the neural tube. The neural tube is a layer of tissue that initially starts out flat and then it kind of grows and rounds up so that it forms a tube, really a tube, just like this. And it closes at the top. It's hollow in the center. And that's where the brain and other nerve structures are derived from the neural tube. And embryologists thought that it was not possible for any neurons to develop prior to the neural tube closing. So one thing that you should know that when we try to study human embryology, we are, of course, necessarily limited by access to tissue. We can't study the human embryo without harming it. And so in order to get tissue for study, you have to have very special conditions because you need generally healthy tissue and you need permission from the parents. And so it's hard to come by tissue. Scientists were able to obtain some tissue for this particular study, and they studied a range of days between 30 and 51 days after conception. And that's what's shown here. And you see markings in the top that say CS12 and down here CS13. Those are some standard terminology used in embryology to mark certain stages of development so you can compare them across different species. In humans, this CS12 happens to be 30 days after conception, and CS13 is 31 days after. And so so what you're seeing here is very early after conception. On this side of the screen, we're looking at a different type of cell called a pioneer cell. On this side, we're looking at a newly discovered cell type called a predecessor neuron. So these predecessor neurons are the earliest known neurons to develop in any species that has a neural tube type process, and they are developing before the neural tube closes. Okay, so that's very distinct. And this is the best slide for seeing the predecessor neurons. Here's the cell body. It has that sort of pyramidal shape that you saw in the earlier slide with neurons. And this is the processes that extend from it. They have much longer processes than most neurons we know of. Most neurons have long processes. These have extraordinarily long processes. And there is something else that's distinct about them, and that is that none of the cells in the cerebrum, in the cerebral cortex, start out in the cerebral cortex. They all start from a deeper layer in the brain, and then once they come into existence through cell division and begin to differentiate into a neuron, they have to migrate up to the surface. And they migrate up to the surface with help from other kinds of neurons, I'm sorry, other kinds of cells that that help to guide them along the way. And these pioneer cells that we're showing on this slide is in fact one of the kinds of cells that serves as a guide to most neurons to get them and help them migrate along the correct path to the top of the cerebral cortex. But predecessor neurons have been shown to have the innate ability on their own to migrate into the proper position. So this is a new discovery, and it's an important right to life or pro-life fact. It's another pro-life fact that we can add to our body of knowledge about human embryology. Okay, so that was one uniqueness at the microscopic level. This previous slide was at 30 days after conception. And in fact, those predecessor neurons may exist earlier, but you know, we can't always just get tissue. We don't know. They haven't had a chance to look any earlier than 30 days. Yeah. So that's very early. That's very early. Yeah. Okay. So we've looked at some uniqueness at in terms of the length of time of pregnancy. We looked macroscopically at the size of our cerebrum and the size of our cerebral of our frontal lobe compared to others. We looked at some uniqueness in terms of these very early predecessor neurons. They haven't found predecessor neurons in any other species yet. They've looked for them. They think they're absolutely unique to humans. Another kind of tissue that neuron that's unique to humans, they've not been able to find in any other species, is a particular type of interneuron. An interneuron is a connecting cell. When they did find me this. Okay. So let's say this is a cerebral cortex in one area, and here's a neuron there. They're kind of pyramidal shaped, and here's another area of the cerebral cortex, and it has a neuron here. These neurons need to communicate with one another. And in fact, the number of connections in our brain is part of what is responsible for our intelligence. It's related to the number of connections we have. And so these neurons need to be connected to one another, but the process from this neuron doesn't go over and directly connect to this one. Instead, they send their fibers down into the, this goes through, so this is the gray matter, and this is the white matter where all the processes are. That's not right. Right. And they actually meet. So here's the end of this. And connect to one another by virtue of this intermediary cell called an interneuron. Okay. So this is the linker, the interneuron. Okay. So because we have so many neurons, we need a lot of interneurons. And they're also discovering that not only do we have a lot of interneurons, we have unique types of interneurons that no other species have. So it also factors into our uniqueness. Yes?
Have any studies been made on the brains of chimps to see if they also get Alzheimer's?
I don't know if that's been done, but... I don't know if it's been. No, I don't know. It may have been done. I don't know. I can check that for you. Well, I just don't know. I mean, to tell you the truth, one of the arguments for God making us with a common body plan is that if God had not made us with a common body plan, a common genetic code, a common biochemistry, how could we do medical research? Can you imagine where our state of knowledge of medicine would be if every single species was completely unique? If the biochemistry was different, if the organ systems were different, evolutionists point to this as a definite proof of evolution. But a compassionate God is going to make a common design so that we have the capacity to get our hands around the body of knowledge in biology and also be able to find cures for diseases. Like, a compassionate God is not going to make every single species unique. I mean, it would be impossible for us to make progress in that particular situation. So we should be doing that research, but I don't. But the problem is that for every kind of research you want to do, you need to have a disease, an animal model for it, and you can't always develop an animal model like you'd like to. You can't always. We don't catch all the same diseases. So I don't know if it's. I don't know if chimps can develop that or not. It may be that given our unique intelligence, we're the only species that can develop it. I don't know. I don't really know the answer to that. Okay, so let's go back and talk about... Oh, go ahead.
When somebody is like autistic or retarded or something, is it because those things don't connect?
I'm actually collecting papers on autism because I happen to have a nephew who has Asperger's syndrome, which is a form of autism. And plus, I'm just interested in it because it's such a tragedy in our society right now. But the truth of the matter is that we don't understand autism very well at all. Just recently, there was a study published that in which 50% of the test subjects had the same genetic problems, and that's actually unusual for an autism study. Most autism studies, they can't find patterns across. Which tells me not all those kids are autistic. But there's finally a study that came out in which 50% of the kids had the same genetic type profile. So I would guess those 50% really have autism. So let me try to stay on track and then we can answer all the questions at the end. So we were going to go back and talk about unique interneurons. So when the human brain is developing, it's as if we need so many interneurons that the normal source of interneurons becomes exhausted and we go to secondary sources. This is a mouse cerebrum shown here, and if it's shown in scale compared to humans, it would be shown this size, and this would be the human. But because we can't read this, it's enlarged here just for us to see. Okay, this is not to scale. But this particular region here, which is called the greater eminence here, this is where the ganglionic eminence is where the interneurons are coming from in the mouse. And they migrate up here, and you see an example of them, but they're actually down below here in the gray matter in there. In humans, they not only come from the ganglionic eminence, but they also come from this ventricular zone and subventricular zone. And the interneurons that come from this tissue have a different set of characteristics. So they behave differently, they form different kinds of connections, their biochemistry is different than the biochemistry of the interneurons that come from here. So they're absolutely a unique cell type. And we're actually going to go over some data later on that will show you there's probably hundreds and hundreds of unique cell types in humans that we just haven't been able to detect yet. We just haven't gotten that far yet. Most of this is very recent research, actually. Okay. So we've talked about some uniqueness here at the microscopic level with some unique cell types, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But now let's talk about uniqueness at the level of the genome. Okay. So recently they found something very astounding here, and it's diagrammed out on this slide. If all of this represents 100% of the genes in an average human, then 76% of those genes, everything inside this yellow circle, 76% of them are expressed in the human brain. Okay. That's huge. There is no other area of our body in which that larger percentage of genes are expressed, and there's no other species in which anywhere near that level of genes are expressed. 76% of all of our genes are expressed in the brain at one time or another during development or postnatally, especially. There's a lot of gene expression switches around a lot the first couple years of development. Yes? Oh, okay. Actually, that's a very good point. Yeah, someone asked that question last time. All of you are aware that our genome is made up of DNA, and that DNA is used to make as a template to make RNA, and then some of that RNA is then used as a template to make proteins. And when a part of the DNA has RNA made from it, and then that RNA is used to make a protein, that's called the gene being expressed. Because the ultimate purpose of the genome is to create proteins. Proteins do most of the work in our cells. And so much of the DNA that's made into an RNA but not made into a protein, that RNA is involved in regulating the other part. And so that still factors into what proteins get expressed. What proteins are made. And so expression of the genome means a protein is made from it. Okay? I think that that definition might actually undergo some change in the near future, because we're finding out that definition was derived more than 10 years ago. In fact, probably more than 20 years ago, before we understood that the vast majority of the genome is actually not expressed in the form of proteins. The vast majority of it is expressed in the form of RNA, and that RNA is absolutely critical. And so I think we might see a change in the definition to where it's changed to encompass RNA being made from the genome. But right now, it's supposed to be protein coming out of as a result of activity starting with the genome. So that means expressed. It gets to have an active role in the cell. It expresses itself through the proteins. Okay. So 76% of the genes are expressed in the brain. And of those, 33% or one-third of them are expressed in differently depending on what region of the brain you're looking at. Okay? Another 28 are expressed in alternative form. That means there's more than one kind of protein you can make from that area of the gene. And an alternative protein coming out is what's being described here. So 28% of them can make alternative proteins, and they do make alternative proteins. And 17% of them are expressed in a different way in different regions and in different forms in different regions. So you see, you have a lot of contingent type expression patterns going on here in the brain. Now, the reason why this is important is every single cell that has a different set of genes expressed makes that an absolutely unique cell type. So the set of genes that are expressed in an individual cell is what gives its unique character. And every time you take one cell and go to the next cell and there's a different set of genes expressed, you have a unique cell type. So you can see that with this much expression going on in the brain and this much of it being regulated differently in different regions, and in different forms, you're going to end up with a lot of unique cell types. And so even at the genome level, we don't know the names of all the different types of neurons, and we haven't been able to tag each of them. We just know there are many, many, many of them, and they're unique to humans.
And 76% are exclusively expressed in the brain?
No, 76% of the genes are expressed in the brain. Some of these are also expressed in other areas. Yeah. For example, like in the brain, you still need some blood tissue and things like that to support it, you know. So some of them are common, but others of them are unique to the brain. I don't know what percentage is expressed only in the brain. And actually, the same protein expressed at a different stage of development can have a completely different action. And so you might have a gene that's expressed in the liver, at one point in time and expressed in the brain at a different point in time, and the result of its activity is completely different. This happens to be a slide of embryonic development, but truthfully, I think that I'll have to go back and look if they included some of the postnatal expression here. I think this may, in fact, be only prenatal. When we're done with the talk, I have my references with you, and I think I want to look at that because I think this may, in fact, be just prenatal, but I'm not sure. I haven't really didn't really think about it at that level before. So you can see what this is saying in terms of unique cell types. And what I'm trying to stress here is the uniqueness of humans. You know, that's our argument against the Evo-Devo community, against the evolutionists, and against those who would say that we're just another animal. Okay. Now, I'm going to give you an example of the kind of data you get when you look at the differential expression of genes. Along these columns are regions of the brain. So you show six different regions of the brain and eight different genes down this side, okay? And red means a very high level of expression, and the dark red means high levels of expression. Dark blue means very low levels of expression. And you can see that for each of these genes, you get different levels of expression in different areas of the brain. And this is a tiny subset of the data. This is the tiniest subset of the data. And so the amount of different neurons is going to be enormous. For example, just if you look at this one gene, just comparing this one gene, you have, see, that's one, two, these are the same, three, four. At least four different cell types represented there. At least four. And you know, when you put it in combination with other things, you get other things. You might get other differences. So when you have all the sets of genes that are active, these may no longer be one cell type here, as they appear just by looking at one gene. Enormous variety of expression. There are hundreds and hundreds of genes that they analyzed in this case. So it's just enormous when you start doing the combinatorial logic on it. Yes?
In terms of the atomic level, isn't all our feelings, our beliefs, our the whole being that we have with our brain, aren't they at bottom just different qualifications of atoms?
I don't think so. We're not just physical entities. We're spiritual entities.
I know, but I mean, down to the atomic level.
If you're asking, do all of our expressions result in chemicals? All of our emotions? Well, sure. When we have emotions, they affect the chemicals in our body, and they will affect the chemicals that we express. But we are not just physical entities. I would never want to leave you with that impression. There's a spiritual dimension to us, a soulish dimension to us that can't be captured in the biochemistry.
It can be proved, then. It can be...
You can't. That's exactly what I said earlier. I said that there's a level of human uniqueness that you can't get at using scientific methods. You can't get at that level using scientific method. It's intangible. I mean, even people who work in this realm cannot define what consciousness is. They can't explain how it came into being because consciousness is not tangible. And how do you get the non-tangible from the tangible? You can't get something greater from the lesser. And so that alone is a proof of some external force interacting with humanity to create that, because you can't get the non-tangible from the tangible. So you can't measure everything about humanity from that. I think this might be our last slide. There's one more slide. Go ahead.
Okay. You talked about genes and turn on all that within the cell.
Right.
Am I correct in stating that when it comes to outside the cell, in embryonic development, what causes cells to grow? over here. It's all liver. And what causes outside the cell, what causes the cells over here to form a heart? We're totally at a loss for that. Plus, the controlling mechanism.
Okay, so my daughter asked me this when she was like in seventh grade. Mom, if I could figure out what made a liver cell and not a kidney cell, would that be a good science fair project? She literally did. And I told her, honey, if you could figure out that, they'd give you the Nobel Prize. So the truth of the matter is that we don't understand. And in fact, I'm trying to dig in and get to more of that level in terms of understanding, but the research is not all there yet. We don't understand how it all gets kicked off. We do know in humans and in primates too that the genes control our development from the get-go. In some other species, the cytoplasm of the egg has some proteins in it that do the first initial cell divisions that are in charge of it. So right away, there's a difference that you start seeing, you know. Where from us, it's genes from the very beginning. But as far as really understanding that, it is incredibly complex. It probably involves hundreds of proteins and RNAs to make that final, you know, decision of how you get to a liver cell. It will probably win some, you know, you could get the Nobel Prize. I'm not kidding. You know, we don't know all the pieces yet.
So you're saying inside the cell, of course, you know, RNA, DNA, protein, outside the cell.
Right. Well, what we do know that there are some cells at very early in embryogenesis, you get some cells which actually secrete chemicals outside of themselves so that other cells can take them up, and those chemicals influence other cells to behave in a certain way. So there's sort of master cells that give off these signals that other cells follow and develop accordingly. We know that's true. However, we don't even understand how that works. They used to say that it was a diffusible gradient, that the chemicals that they were secreting diffused out, and the cells that were closest to them got the biggest impact. Cells that were further away got lesser and lesser impact. And so you would see sort of a gradient, and there would be a gradient of behavior in response to that chemical. Well, now the leading embryologists who work in this area say it's diffusible gradients are definitely not how it's carried out, because that's just too haphazard. And it's not diffusible gradients. We don't know what it is, but it's not diffusible gradients. So there are things going on outside the cell, but we just don't know. Yeah.
When you lose protein as you get older in the brain, and you do, it doesn't
even fade. I don't know. You're saying, do you lose gene expression in some areas? Yeah. I don't really know. I do know. Your gene expression changes throughout your lifetime. And yes, there are some changes that accompany old age, but they don't know how to correct that. I mean, that's really complicated. We don't know how to connect. Can we do this final slide?
Well, this is tied in with the first thing.
Okay.
It's very important that talking about the cell, that as I understand, obviously, the brain cells and our nerve cells are the ones that don't regenerate. I mean,
right.
What you're born with is what you have if you die with, unlike... So your intestines are
right.
Short a couple
right.
of days.
Yeah.
These cells have to be around a long time.
Right.
And they're very big, very long.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. There are some, definitely there's some problems that we know about in Alzheimer's. There's protein plaques that form where you get these proteins behaving abnormally instead of being in solution like they're supposed to be. They form clumps. They're called plaques. But... understanding exactly why that happens. Still working on it. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so let's talk about one more level down. Now we're going to talk at the molecular level. And this is an RNA molecule called HAR1F, and that stands for Human Accelerated Region, I think it is. Okay. So what happened was, in terms of from a historical perspective, a lot of the scientists who need to understand what makes humans absolutely unique were really looking forward to getting the human genome sequence. They thought that when we got the human genome sequence and then the chimp genome, and we could compare them, in the genes we would see all the differences that would account for human uniqueness, and we'd be in good shape. We got the human genome, chimp genome, and lo and behold, the genes, the ones that actually, the ports that actually have the message for protein coding, there's not that much difference between human and chimps. So they threw up their hands, of course. They were frustrated initially. And some of the quotes that you see that I put on the screen earlier was some of that frustration. So for some of these scientists, they really need to know what makes humans unique, and they were frustrated that they didn't get it when the Genome Project came out. It is true that evolutionists overstate the similarity between humans and chimps, but nevertheless, there's a lot more similarity than they thought. And I can tell you that I do other talks in which I talk about the fact that very small changes can make a very big difference. And but what happened in this particular case was that a number of scientists who were working together said, okay, so we're not finding the difference in the genes that we expected to see, so let's take a bunch of mammals, but not humans, and let's look at the areas of their DNA that don't code for proteins. It's called the non-coding regions. They make RNA instead. And let's compare them across all these mammals and see the ones that have the same sequence from one mammal to another. Because if you have the same sequence, that means it generally means it has a function and it's important for something. And the reason it has to have the same sequence is because it's doing something. It's just like saying, I'm going to make a car, but it's not going to have an engine. Well, there is no such thing as a car without an engine because it can't go. And so, you know, once God had decided on the laws of chemistry and physics for our universe, then if he was using a certain kind of molecule to do something, you had to have the same molecule of other species to do the same thing, because he had chosen a set of laws of physics and chemistry, and he couldn't violate his own set of laws. And so you will see this similarity across species. And so they identified a couple hundred regions that were almost identical across all mammals. And generally, they were 100% identical across all mammals. And then they took that 200 or so set, and they said, now, let's compare those to the same region of the DNA in humans and see if they're the same or different. We're only interested in the ones that are very different in humans. They found 49 regions of non-coding DNA, it makes RNA, that are very different in humans. And they named those areas of human accelerated evolution, or human accelerated regions, HARs. And the one that was most different is this one right here. This is 119 nucleotides, I believe. I don't think all 119 are shown here. That doesn't look like 119. But the whole stretch is 119 bases in DNA. And there were 18 changes from chimp to human, 18. Now, in evolutionary terms, an evolutionist would say in that amount of evolutionary time, there should be 0.25 bases changing. Only 0.25, and you have 18. So that's 4 times 18, or 72 times as much change as there should be. And so one of the things I'm going to look at is that I'm going to look at the sequence very carefully, the whole thing. And because most of the changes were from AU base pairs to GC base pairs. And that is not how it normally happens in species. There is an enzyme in our bodies that goes around and can convert GCs to AUs, but there's not any known mechanism for converting the AUs to GCs. That's, you know, rampant going on in our cells, and yet you see 18 changes of that type going on here. And so what they did once they found this RNA, they studied it, and they found this expressed in the brain, not surprisingly, in the cerebral cortex. And it's detected at first in humans at 7 to 9 weeks of gestation. That's the earliest they could detect it. And the very first place they detected cerebral cortex. And it continued to be expressed exclusively in the cerebral cortex until 17 to 19 weeks of gestation, after which time it was expressed in a number of different areas of the brain. And so even at the level of individual molecules, we have molecules completely unique to humans. So that's my real point here today, and I'm going to summarize with this slide. Human uniqueness is evident even at the historical level. As soon as humans came onto the scene, there's the cultural Big Bang, where in spite of the fact that you hear anthropologists talking about the use of tools by hominids. The reality is there were only two types of tools that were used by hominids, and the first one, once it came onto the scene, stayed like for a couple million years, and then there was a new kind of tool set that hominids were using, a new tool that went on for the next couple million years, and that's all hominids did. As soon as modern humans, us, our species, came on the scene, there was an explosion in a wide variety of tools, and they were constantly changing. There was jewelry, there was art, there were musical instruments found. So once humans came on the scene, everything changed dramatically. So even at the historical level, we see a big difference, a big footprint for human uniqueness. At the macroscopic level, you see differences in the time of gestation, in the time of plasticity of the brain following birth, an extended time, in terms of the size of the cerebral cortex, 10 times larger than even chimps, much more convoluted to accommodate all the neurons. And remember, we also have lots of additional connections between neurons. Microscopically, we have many unique neurons. And we talked about two types today. We talked about the predecessor neurons that are found at 30 days after conception and perhaps earlier than anyone thought they could be there. And we also talked about the unique interneurons. And genomically, we talked about the fact that so much of the genome is expressed in the brain, and that with all the differential expression going on in the brain, every time you get a cell that has a unique set of genes being expressed, then you have a unique cell type. So we don't know how many unique cell types we have in the brain, but there's a lot of them. There's a lot of unique cell types in the brain, in the human brain. And at the molecular level, we now have 49 areas that are RNAs that are radically different from what they are in any other mammal. And we're just now beginning to study these, to find out how these RNAs regulate and shape the development of our brain. There are a few genes that are unique to the human brain, that are only found in the human brain. And perhaps I'll expand my talk to include that as well. But I just felt like I had enough in here already. So that's, and let me just look. Here's my, let's see if I can find. This is the paper that we were, where I showed you the gene expression levels. So it is genes expressed in specific areas of the human fetal cerebral cortex display distinct patterns of evolution. So this, those were, I think that the 76% of expression is in prenatally only, I think. Okay, now questions. Who hasn't asked them so far? You have it, okay.
Okay, are there any clues in these studies that might help explain the Mars Venus?
Men and women?
Yeah.
I haven't seen anything that's sex specific yet. I haven't run across anything that's specific as far as that. Yes.
Are you going to come out with a paper or a book?
It's going to be a book. It's going to be a book. But this, well, the goal is for me, by the time I'm done, is to have a book contract and an outline for a book. And then, you know, hopefully about a year after that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Year and a half. So.
Good stuff.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, that's very good.
Dr. Faber, yeah.
A couple of things. We're all familiar with the biology books that shows the fetus.
Yeah.
Of a dog.
I know.
They all look the same.
Yeah. Haeckel's embryos is what they're called. This is what you're referring to, Haeckel's embryos. This is fudged data, okay? And it's known to be fudged. It's called Haeckel's, okay, I think it's spelled like that, embryos. Okay. So this embryologist named Haeckel published his work around 1850. He was a big Darwinian activist. And we didn't know at the time what he was doing, but later it was found that what he'd done is he'd taken drawings of the fetus of a number of organisms, and he published them saying that this was the same stage of development, all these different fetuses, and look how they all look alike. Humans are just another animal. It was later found out that he fudged a lot of the drawings. And that he, even though he said it was the same stage of development across them, it wasn't. He picked and chose the ones that would show what he wanted to show. And they're still used in textbooks now. And we've known for since like the 1920s that this data was all fudged. And they're still used.
Is there any research on that?
I mean, there's a book called Icons of Evolution. Icons of Evolution. It's a video and a book, and it does talk about this. But I think all of you know that it's just about impossible to get a lot of this stuff into the mainstream. But there's a book and a video called Icons of Evolution, and this is one of the topics it talks about. It talks about a lot of things that are held up as icons that, in fact, aren't real. They're not, the data's fudged or it's misleading or something. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. This was the saying that went along with it, and it was meant to say that within the embryonic phases of an organism, you demonstrate all the species you were before you became human. Okay. You know that I think it's ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. It's now known to be false. Recapitulates phylogeny. This is not true. This is false. Okay, so this is false.
It sounds good.
It sounds good, yeah. I was taught this when I was an undergraduate in embryology. Yeah. Yes.
And you the fact that they now know that there's at least three other hominids that walk the earth along with Homo sapiens.
Yeah.
Were there, of course, there's no way of knowing, but do you think their brains were the same as ours?
No.
They had consciousness.
How do you know they had consciousness?
Well, we don't know. But, I mean, they were hominids.
Yeah, that isn't.
They had brains.
Well, they had brains. Yeah, they had brains, but their brain sizes were not the same. I mean, we do know about the brain sizes, a lot of them, because we have skulls.
Yeah, like Neanderthals. You know, they had a bigger brain than we have.
Yeah, no, not based. Not they don't have. They have a smaller encephalization quotient, which is the ratio of brain size to body mass, and that's what's really important. They had a bigger body, so they had to have a bigger brain. But if you look at encephalization quotient, which is the mass of the brain relative to the body, we have the largest.
Yeah, but they have to have consciousness. They actually made it with Homo sapiens.
No, that doesn't mean anything. There are people who mate with horses. You have to realize it's a sin. It's a sin. Yeah, but I mean, you know, no, I don't know that they have consciousness. I can't say that.
We don't know.
No, yeah.
Hi. My way.
Okay.
I might process a lot of it. The synapses drawing you have over there, where,
synapses,
where,
yeah.
Yeah, where the little
interneurons connect, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Kind of traumatic effect or car accident, or, I don't know anything. And, you know, people take all sorts of therapies and those things reconnect.
They do.
Is that unique, or is that just everybody kind of?
You mean every human or other species?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Is that a unique thing that can repair?
I don't know, because I don't know how much time we spent devote to therapy in animals, and I don't know that. Since they can't understand instructions, I don't know if it's a fair comparison. I don't know. Truthfully, I think that God gave animals the ability to recover from accidents too, but I just don't know. Yeah.
Let's go then. Is there more research? Obviously, you talked about a paper recently talking about the necessity that we don't use all of our brain. We talked about that. And yet it's found out that in order for us to have our intelligence, our speech, even our spiritual aspect, we actually have to have this part of our brain that, quote unquote, is not used.
Right.
And what she's talking about is those reconnections. It's not just a brain repair. It's just that it makes different connections.
Yeah, makes different connections.
Once you do a nerve cell, that nerve cell is there for the whole life. And then with damage, it's gone.
Yeah.
Muscle.
Yeah.
Okay.
That point you made about the humankind needing more time to develop.
Right.
And I think of the gazelle, you know, jumps out of the female.
Yeah.
In 4 hours, it's running, seeing,
yeah.
You know, reaching, all those things, using its tongue, eating. where a human, you know, it's years before it can reach its arms out to see.
Yeah.
The depth perception of hearing.
Yeah.
But a gazelle, it's 2 hours.
Yep, right. Yeah. Yeah, and all that extended time in an infantile state gives us time to acquire more knowledge and develop more interconnectedness between our neurons. Yes.
Did you say
interneurons? Interneurons.
Are they unique to humans?
No, other species have interneurons, but we have more of them and more types of them. Yeah. Yes.
I've heard that the short system is put them in high pressure oxygen. Even years later, the symptoms diminish or go away.
I don't know.
Oxygen regenerates the brain.
I don't know anything about it. Yeah. You have another question? No.
No.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
In all your research, has there been any explanation for what we call instinct? I mean, I'm totally amazed that animals have apparent intelligence from these biological, and yet we don't see instinct in the genome.
I don't know the answer to that. That's a very interesting question. I've been focused so much on humans that I haven't really looked at animal instinct.
Well, even human instinct. We have some
instincts too.
Much,
yeah. For example, I mean the baby nurses instinctively, knows how to nurse instinctively. I don't know what instinct comes from. I don't know. Yes.
Yeah, you say that God made our brains.
Yeah.
Why do we have Alzheimer's, which robs us of everything you know is gone in a few years?
You're asking the classic question of why is there evil, the existence of evil. It is a natural evil. It's disease. Why does God allow there to be disease and suffering and things like that? I mean, that, you know, I'm a scientist. I'm not a specialist in that area. So I would give you the same kinds of answers that other Christians would probably give you, that it's not God's desire for the world to be this way, and he's going to redeem it one day. His desire is to end all human suffering. It wasn't his desire for us to have a fallen nature and to experience all these things, but...
If Hugh Ross was here, he would look you at the face and say, I've asked you to read Beyond the Cosmos. Have you done it? Do you have the book? If not, I'll buy you one. Do you have Beyond the Cosmos? No, Al, ask my question. Beyond the Cosmos? Okay, after class, we'll buy you. Do you promise to read it?
Just one
more. Do you promise to read it?
Yes, I promise.
Thank you. Okay, go on, your question.
I promise.
Very good.
So here you are. If you're a Christian, you believe in the Bible and all that stuff, and God. You get the Alzheimer's. You're a total atheist. I mean, you don't believe in anything. No, that's not true.
You
go to heaven, that's
a lie. There are some people.
No, go ahead.
A friend of mine, her grandmother was basically dying of dementia. And before she died, she sang in.
Yeah.
So she sang a hymn to her daughter.
Yeah. I have a grandmother who was.
Her faith was intact.
Yeah.
Well, she had Alzheimer's. She didn't seem to know anything, but she suddenly became lucid, and it was clear that she wasn't
happy. Al, are you a Christian?
No.
Okay. Well, yeah. Okay. Well, no. I mean, it's not surprising. I mean, that's certainly not surprising given the questions you've been asking and some of the statements you've made. It's not surprising. But I'll give you an example from my own life. I was very close to my grandmother. She raised me, and she's a very devout Catholic. I was raised Catholic. And my Catholic faith really shaped my morality. And I was a very devout Catholic. And then in college, I grew up in South Louisiana. I'm French. Everybody was Catholic. I didn't even know. I know two Protestant families growing up. So I wasn't exposed to the Bible or anything. And then when I went to college, that was the first time I got exposed to Protestants and went to Bible study and became an evangelical Christian. But certainly I feel like my relationship with God extended further back than that. But nevertheless, very close to my grandmother, devout Catholic. And when I was about 25 years old, I was living in Texas. And my grandmother was finally becoming senile and getting near death. And I came back to visit her. And my aunt was with her in the hospital. And when I walked in, my grandmother said, "Oh, Patricia, I knew you'd be coming soon." And she just talked to me. And I saw my aunt sitting in the corner kind of crying. And I didn't know what was going on. And afterwards, she pulled me out of the hall and she said, "Your grandmother has not said a lucid word in 2 weeks. She's been talking about the chickens under the house," because she grew up, you know, in rural Louisiana where there were chickens under the floorboards and everything. And she'd been talking about the milk and the cows and all these other things. And she said, "You walked in, it's like bang." And I felt like, and then a few weeks later, my grandmother died. And I only had a short time to spend with her. I feel like it was a gift from God, that lucidity, for me to have that conversation with my grandmother for that short while. We don't understand. There are things we don't understand. No, that's not. Because we don't understand them, that's not why we call him God. The fact that he's a being beyond our nature is why we don't understand them. Yes?
I have a friend that has stroke and her memory was just washed out. And you know the thing that's interesting? She can still play the piano and she plays the piano.
Yeah.
She sings.
Well, and as Christians, we certainly believe that our relationship with God is not lost because of what's going on in our brain. As Christians, we know that our relationship with God is permanent and that no matter what happens to our brain, our relationship with God is cemented and we'll be with him in heaven where we'll be whole again. So, yes?
I'm sorry, we need to close this prayer.
Okay. Okay. You can come up afterwards and ask questions. Oh, okay, yeah, me, okay. Father, I thank you for the opportunity to learn all this material and to have time to study like this, and that you've given us the ability to understand your creation and to gain understanding of it. I thank you for this class, and I pray that this information will be of use to them and encouraging them in their faith and providing them with the tools they need to answer challenges to their faith. Bless us all as we go forth from here now today. Amen. And in your son's name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
You caught me off guard. You have a question for me?
I got a comment on Heckel's embryos.
Yeah.
I heard you might have to check.